I'm Frank Vaughn. It is February 11th, 2025. And just a shout out to the community. You know, you guys are great. I never have to tell you to like, share, and subscribe or any of the repetition that other channels have to go through. You guys are engaged at a very high rate, and I thank you for that. And with that being sincerely said, we're going to talk about all kinds of things today, so we need to dive in. Western Canada, Ottawa, Trump. But first, a lesson in geopolitics. Geopolitics simply means the politics of geography, where things are. And that's a simplistic way of putting it. Canada's two nations. I've said that before. There's Western Canada with a settlement arc like this, and there's Eastern Canada where all the people live in a settlement arc like this. The goods and money flow south or overseas from Eastern Canada, and the goods and money in Western Canada flow south or overseas from Western Canada. There is only one road link between the two halves. It is rarely ever busy. I've driven it. There is very little in terms of rail link. I think there's only one heavy rail link that does both halves. Two countries. And to understand how Western Canada has been struggling for its survival and its prosperity against Eastern Canada, we have to go back to before the beginning, before there was a Western Canada. This man was John Palliser. He was sent west in the 1850s to survey the land and find how agriculturally viable it was. So he came and he reasonably concluded, if you follow my mouse, that there is a fertile arc across the middle section of Saskatchewan, now Saskatchewan and Alberta, down towards Calgary. And he went back and he reported his findings. And the East didn't like that. It was bad news in their mind, because he also found that down here was suitable for rangeland. And he said that this should not be farmed. They didn't like the news. So they sent Henry Yule Hind. He came out here and he said, everything's hunky-dory. You can settle and you can farm this lower piece as much as you want. And that was the start of the misery. Moving forward in time, about 20, 30 years, that brings us to something we were all taught about in public school, especially me. I grew up in Ontario, and we were taught that the Canadian Pacific Railroad was a feat of human engineering, which it was, that united a country and made everybody happy. But the reality of the situation is far more complex. First, the CPR was formed and given a monopoly so nobody else would be able to lay track. They were gifted $25 million in taxpayer money, which was a huge sum of money at the time. 25 million acres, 700 miles of track that was already laid at the expense of the Canadian taxpayer. And more importantly, the Canadian government made no demands on where they would lay their future track. Now, people are not stupid, especially the people who settled this land. They occupied the fertile arc. This is where they wanted to farm. This is where they wanted to live. Those who settled down here got destroyed because the climate is inhospitable, especially if you don't have irrigation. And in terms of building a rail line, Eastern Canada's goal was to enhance rail traffic and move people and facilitate the settling of the land. A rail track through the north, right through the Yellowhead Pass, which was a much more easily navigated piece of the Rocky Mountains versus what ended up happening down here. Instead, the CPR, who had their own goals, which were contrary to Canada's and contrary to the interests of the people who were living in the West, decided to route their railroad, and you can actually see it on the map, through the south. Now, mind you, they were picking up some of the coal from Estevan, but they could have done that anyway. They went through this dry rangeland, and they navigated some really inhospitable mountains to actually build their railroad. The result was they cut off the people who were actually living here, increased their freight expenses, increased the cost of getting their stuff on trains because they had to haul it so far, and it took forever to get branch lines built, and it slowed the development of the West, and it really hurt a lot of people. Now, maybe you're wondering why I'm opening with a history lesson, but you have to understand that Western Canada has had to fight for its existence since the very beginning and even before the very beginning. I'm going to go to Ed Whitcomb's wonderful book, The Short History of Saskatchewan. I'm just going to read some excerpts. The settlers were already experiencing the ill effects of the federal government's national policy. Because of tariffs, they were paying more for goods than American farmers across the border. The CPR charged 35 cents to ship a barrel of wheat to England when American farmers were paying half as much. Between 1881 and 1884, the price of wheat fell from $1.34 per bushel to 84 cents. While the federal government raised tariffs on agricultural machinery from 25% to 35%. This is a theme. The extraction of value from the West by the East is something that is perpetual. It's been here since we started the project. Many settlers could not obtain title to their land, and some of that land was even being assigned to speculators. Politically, the whites were impotent as they had no members of Parliament, and the governor and his five advisors were appointed, not elected. In 1883, a group of farmers organized the Manitoba and Northwest Farmers Union at a meeting in Prince Albert. In December, they drafted a Declaration of Rights demanding an end to the CPR monopoly, the right of provinces to charter railways, provincial control of natural resources, which is ours by right, a railway to Hudson Bay, the abolition of tariffs on agricultural machinery, authority of the municipalities to build elevators and mills, and the appointment of government grain inspectors. The complaints, letters, protests, petitions produced no response from Ottawa. Eastern arrogance, Eastern ignorance, Eastern lack of any concern for the welfare of the West that extends into 2025 today has its seeds in history. The farmers contacted the Métis. At a joint meeting in February 1884, a Bill of Rights was adopted and included the previous grievances and also requested a fair deal for the native peoples, land titles for the Métis, improvements to the Homestead Act, representation in Ottawa. Officials pleaded with the Prime Minister, Mr. MacDonald. He refused to talk to them. Who else refuses to talk to the people? Justin Trudeau, when he refused to talk to the Freedom Convoy. Justin Trudeau, when he refuses to talk to Old Canada. The whites and the Métis asked Louis Riel to come back from Montana to lead them. In 1869, Riel had seized the leadership of the revolt at Red River, organized an effective provisional administration, and forced the federal government to grant provincial status to Manitoba and rights to all of its inhabitants. It was a remarkable feat and made him truly one of the fathers of Confederation. He seemed the logical choice. Now, unfortunately, Mr. Riel had suffered a mental breakdown between the Manitoba Rebellion and the Saskatchewan Rebellion that would follow. But the fact is, the federal government was screwing Manitoba over as well. They had to revolt, and that was the only reason they got their provincial rights. Now, when it comes to Riel in Saskatchewan, the Northwest Rebellion was an unnecessary tragedy. One of the main causes was reducing the natives' food ration to save money. This is another area where everybody needs a reminder. The Indian Act comes from the East. The Indian Act, which causes untold suffering unto today. The Indian Act, which prevents anybody that's living on a reserve from ever having private property. Billions and billions of dollars are poured into the reserve system, and it benefits the bands. It benefits certain individuals, and everybody else loses. It was also designed to address a people who were nomadic in nature, but now were no longer nomads. They were settled. The Indian Act is so outmoded, it's still there, and it's still there to this day because of the East. And where did the residential school idea come from? It came from the East. Bringing it back to the Northwest Rebellion for a minute, you have to understand that the demands of the Métis, the demands of the Indians, the demands of the whites were quite reasonable, but the federal government said no and refused to talk. Now, the federal government was engaged in a starvation program trying to save money, so their idea of saving money at the time was to just simply cut the native food ration and starve them to death. This is in addition to all the restrictions that were placed on natives who were nomadic by nature, were unable to travel from reserve to reserve, but these are all things that need a timetable of their own. Instead, the Northwest Rebellion broke out, and the federal government spent $5 million, a huge sum of money, putting it down and didn't address any of the primary concerns. They just killed a bunch of people, jailed a bunch of people, and didn't address any of the primary concerns. The suffering continued. The West wanted to do something sensible. The East used military force to crush them. Now, in the interest of time, we have to skip forward a little bit, and we're not going to talk about the Canadian Wheat Board, which arguably wouldn't have been necessary if we had built the track in the right darn place in the first place, to Pierre Trudeau, a man who is hated and reviled here like no other character, and is the reason the Liberal Party will never do well here. In the 1970s, there was an oil boom where Alberta and Saskatchewan could have really prospered from those higher prices, but not so. Pierre came along and he capped the price of a barrel of oil at the wellhead and slapped tariffs on exports, all for the benefit of Central Canada at the expense of the West. And this is a theme. They treat the West like a piggy bank, the governments and the elites of Eastern Canada, a separate country that rules over Western Canada. There was also the fiasco when he said, why should I sell your wheat? Because he came here to find out what was going on. Because, breaking with tradition, he didn't just ignore the West. He actually wanted to come and thumb his nose at Western Canada. And so protesters gathered, and they were a little bit mean in communicating with Pierre Trudeau. And he said, if you treat me this way, why should I bother to sell your wheat? They view us as property. You need to understand that, because that continues to this day. The West exists. When the tariff threat comes down, the first over the wall, they said, would be Alberta. We'll cut off energy supplies. We'll cut off minerals. We will kill you in our fight to prosecute a pointless war that we can't win with the United States, with Donald Trump, over something very simple. All the corruption that I've been telling you about, all the drug manufacture and exportation, all of the issues that Team Canada has united around, and they had the nerve to say that Daniel Smith and Scott Moe, the only two people that are taking the Americans at face value and serious, because they know where their bread is buttered, and they know where Western Canada aligns. We don't align east, we align south. They said, we're going to risk your economy first. Pierre also had the National Energy Program, which was another attempt to rob the West blind. Saskatchewan had to set up the Saskatchewan Potash Corporation. I've always said that I don't get too lost in the weeds here, because this wasn't supposed to be some kind of historical documentary. But socialism in Saskatchewan and in the West arose as a necessary and very different type of socialism to the socialism that rose in the rest of the world. It was protectionist in nature. Not just protecting from foreign competition, but protection against Ottawa, who was committed to violating provincial rights to rob resources blind for the benefit of those in central Canada. And I want you to understand that it is a bipartisan issue. It didn't matter what government was in Ottawa. They are constantly screwing Western Canada for their own benefit. Pictured on screen is Brian Mulroney, a man my father affectionately called Melonhead. He brought in something called the GST. Was particularly hard on resource economies like Western Canada. He's not thought of very well either. Just another Laurentian elite screwing Western Canada. The only thing I want you to get out of that entire segment is an understanding that the Americans, the United States, has been giving Western Canada a better deal this entire time. The existence of Western Canada and its prosperity comes in spite of Eastern Canada, comes from fighting something hard fought and won from Eastern Canada. What does Eastern Canada give us? Military exercises with the PLO, the People's Liberation Army, the Communist Party. This is the Government of Canada website. Warmington, one of the best journalists in Canada right now in a mainstream publication. Communist Chinese troops observed military exercises on Canadian soil. Yes, we're training the enemy. Not only do they operate police stations on Canadian soil, not only do they ship all the raw ingredients for the drug super labs that were busting, shipping drugs all over the world. 83% of Australia's methamphetamine comes from Canada. Fentanyl, human trafficking, and more importantly, money laundering, which is putting out of reach housing for all of Canada. You can't afford a house because of money laundering that benefits the Chinese Communist Party. Canadian military found Chinese monitoring boys in the Arctic. Canada's ties to China's military underscore the weird contradictions of its foreign policy. Why Ottawa let Chinese forces attend a military science meet in Canada? Liberals dismayed that military exercises with China were canceled. Secret documents reveal. We would have never known how badly the Liberals wanted to jump into bed with the Communist Party of China if these secret documents weren't released. They were dismayed that it all ended. But there's something more subtle here, and that is cocaine, fentanyl, methamphetamine, heroin. I think the close collaboration between the Canadian government and its militaries with the Communist Party of China and its military risked putting too much attention on the close ties between China and Canada. You can't have it. I almost feel like the entire fiasco, the diplomatic row between China and Canada that was projected over the last couple of years, was a PR campaign to keep eyeballs off of what's really going on, the things that people like myself and Sam Cooper and Clyde we're trying to talk about, which is the massive scale of criminality in Canada. Remember, back in 2023, ex-diplomat claimed Trudeau's plane was full of cocaine during India visit. Canada PM responds. Now, it should be noted that these are unsubstantiated allegations that the government denied and Trudeau denied. Everybody denied that anything happened. This guy also went on to say that Trudeau was so coked out that he couldn't keep a meeting with the leader of the Indian government. And of course, he denied it. But why should we believe his denials? He denied blackface. That was true. He denied the ethics violations. That was true. He denied Gropergate, where he admitted paying a settlement to somebody, and then he gaslit her, saying that two people can have a different memory or experience of the same actions. He lies as easily as everybody else breathes. So why should we believe him? Look at Chrystia Freeland, his right-hand lady. She's on, I think, methamphetamine. She looks like she's tweaking in half of her press conferences. She just can't keep the glass pipe away from her mouth. Chrystia, sue me for defamation. Let's get a drug test on you. That would be awesome. I think all politicians should have to subject themselves to drug tests. How about that? Can we have mandatory drug testing for politicians so we can figure out what kind of hardcore narcotics they're on and maybe link them back in some way to the massive scale of crime that's going on in this country that your mainstream media doesn't seem to want to tell you about? So while Daniel Smith and Scott Moe do everything they can to signal to the Americans that they are our true and natural partners. Again, this is what the East gives us, how the RCMP, CBSA, and Trudeau government lost U.S. trust in the fentanyl fight. This from Sam Cooper, who's been doing some incredible work. It was mind-boggling, the Americans would say. We have good reason to suspect that this particular CBSA officer is corrupt, a Canadian policing expert said. This information would be provided to higher-ups at CBSA with the understanding that this particular officer is not to show up at any future joint meeting. So eventually, there would be a meeting and the CBSA officer in question would show up at the meeting. The lead American investigator would end the meeting before it started. The Americans would shake their heads in disgust and disbelief. The border, as it's now run, is Homeland Security. They have no respect for CBSA. None. CBSA were seen as tax collectors for picking on families coming across the border with two bottles of wine and not actually doing police seizures of proper amounts of drugs coming through the border. It is... the Americans know. That's why Trump signed the executive orders. That's why we're in the situation we're in right now. This isn't to say that every CBSA officer is corrupt, but the corruption has to be at the state level for the amount of trafficking that we are seeing to be able to go on. It's insane. The Americans won't talk to us. They won't share intelligence because they know our state apparatus is corrupt. And while the mainstream media today is united in its outrage at the injustice of American steel and aluminum tariffs, it's not just Canadian media, it's European Union media as well, and talk of Canada joining the European Union, foolishly being promoted by our national media, everybody likes to forget. U.S. opens new investigations into Canadian fabricated steel imports because we were using your tax dollars to subsidize big business, our steelmakers, and they were dumping their excess steel on the American market, hurting U.S. steelmakers. This was happening by China, this was happening by Mexico, and it was completely undermining the U.S. steel industry. The consequences of that cast a shadow. And here we are today with a 25% tariff on those products. This is why. Does the media tell you the history? Does the media tell you the story? We could get into all kinds of details, which we have. Watch the previous videos. They're timeless. You don't have to watch a video that was put out today. Watch them all. They're timeless. They're full of information. And what's another thing Eastern Canada has given us, Eastern government, Laurentian elites? They've given us Hamas. They've given us Hezbollah on our streets, waving flags of their terrorist organizations, laundering money, sending far more terrorists into the United States than Mexico could ever hope for. 500% more terrorists cross from Canada, well-moneyed terrorists into the United States, people on the terror watch list. And who is Hamas? Who are these Palestinians of Gaza? They sit on close to $1 trillion of gas wealth. They sit on oil wealth. Hamas is led by billionaires. Now, admittedly, some of them are dead now because of the recent war. So while agents of Hamas and Hezbollah organize on our soil, while they launder money here, I've covered it in my previous videos, they are benefiting. They are exporting wealth to fund their terrorist operations while they're taking over our streets every single weekend, while they're boycotting the poor, honest Canadian business that's just trying to get by and pay taxes. The people who lead them sit on top of billions of dollars. They resist the development of the wealth that sits under the Palestinian people's feet. These people sit on top of the heap of the Palestinian people and reap all the benefit. Did you know that per capita, Palestine is one of the largest recipients of international aid, also known as money laundering? That's what we're learning with USAID. That's what we're learning about comparable Canadian agencies, that it's another money laundering racket. We know that the money that we're sending to Ukraine is being laundered and it finds its way into politicians' pockets. This isn't new information. This is news. But who is putting it on their front page every single day? Hamas runs loose in Canada. They are free to organize. Their rallies, there isn't a Canadian flag in sight. Compare and contrast. When the Israeli diaspora, the Jewish diaspora, has a rally, it is Jewish flags and it is Canadian flags all day. They don't burn buildings down. They don't smash windows. They're not boycotting businesses. They're just trying to go about their lives. From a Canadian perspective, I'm asking you, who is more destructive a force? Are the Jews laundering money? Have I found any evidence of Israel laundering drug money in Canada? I haven't. I'd tell you if I did. If you want to show me some real evidence, I'll see it. But I haven't found it. But I have found China. I have found Hamas. I have found Hezbollah. These billionaires who consume the wealth of the world, sitting on top of the heap of Palestinian people who live in shantytowns, who live in deplorable conditions. And there's all this outrage about Trump talking about taking over Gaza. You hear about that all the time. You don't hear him speak about it. So without the filter of outraged politicians and activists and mainstream media, let's listen to Trump talk about Israel for a moment. He is reacting to hostages that were released.
I mean, the one guy was laughing when one of the hostages, he thought his family was alive, found out the family was dead, and His captor started laughing because he thought it was so funny. You know, this is a different group of people. No, I would say Saturday at 12, we want them all back. I'm speaking for myself. Israel can override it. But from myself, Saturday at 12 o'clock, and if they're not here, all hell is going to break out.
Mr. President, in an interview this weekend, you said that Palestinians would not be guaranteed the right to return to Gaza if the U.S. were to develop it. What did you mean by that?
We've spoken to a lot of Palestinians. They would love to leave Gaza if they could find a place to be. And I've spoken to various leaders of various countries in the not-so-distant area from where we're talking about, the Gaza Strip. And I think they were very positive about providing land. What we need is land. And if we could build a nice place for people to live safely, everybody in Gaza would do it. They've been persecuted. They've been spit on. They've been treated like trash. And they would love to get out of Gaza. But until now, they never had an alternative.
Something I have not seen the mainstream media cover is the last part of that segment, where he talks about how they've been spit on and how they've been treated terribly, how the Gazans have suffered. Their economic viability has been resisted by their own leaders. They are surrounded by the Israelis. There are excesses committed against the Palestinians all day. Likewise, because of the nature and proximity of the conflict, because of the nature of the education system by Hamas, where the kids are taught to hate the Israelis with every fiber of their being and plan for the day that they die in glorious martyrdom, the parents push the children towards the soldiers with stones as part of their upbringing. This conflict, to resolve it, to actually make the two peoples live in peace, requires a degree of separation and a degree of much larger thinking. Now, people don't like pain. People like to cling to the past. They don't like the pain of the present, so they focus on the pain of the past. This happens here in Canada. We talk about, as I have in this video, the Indian Act, the residential schools, but we are here now. And if we don't get on with being here now and getting on with the future together, we're going to be swallowed by the globalist world that wants to replace all of us. I'm going to show you something next that's really disturbing. It is the same with Israel and Palestine. A lasting solution requires a degree of separation. What is wrong with relocation? If that relocation, even if it's done to a certain degree, leads to prosperity, leads to peace, leads to people being able to live in secure accommodation. Whatever vision creates peace in that region is going to require sacrifice on the part of both parties. There's no going back. It's an irreconcilable problem, symbolized, as a matter of fact, with the Dome of the Rock sitting right on top of Temple Mount. I mean, of all the real estate in the world, the dome had to go there on top of the Temple Mount. If you're going to cut that Gordian knot, it's going to require some thinking, and it's going to require some present-day pain and accommodation to move on into a future where we can avoid killing each other. Now, before I get to the bit, what I wanted to show you, do African Americans in the United States who have a grievance with slavery justified? Do any of them really want to go back to Africa? Do they really want to stop being Americans? We have to get together in the moment to proceed into the future, a future built for everybody, a future that has to oppose these guys. French far-left leader Mélenchon openly calls for great replacement and shocks speech. We are destined to be a Creole nation, and so much the better. In our country, one person in four has a foreign grandparent. 40% of the population speaks at least two languages. We are destined to be a Creole nation, and so much the better. May the young generation be the great replacement for the old generation. Kill whitey. Maybe that's why they love South Africa so much, because that's the philosophy that's dominating down there too. Another thing that Trump is paying attention to. There's a genocide going on in South Africa, but nobody seems to care about it because it's a genocide against white people. And while the French people face genocidal maniacs from within, an existential crisis from within, hoping for the death of their culture and their people, Canada's news cycle yesterday drudged up this guy, Stéphane Dion, the failed leader of the Liberal Party. If it wasn't for failed leadership, the Liberal Party wouldn't have anything going for it. Because you have the failed leadership of this man, you have the failed leadership of Bob Rae. Can you believe that Bob Rae is actually in politics? Anybody from Ontario? Can you believe that Bob Rae has any relevance after the destruction his communistic ideology wrought on the people of Ontario? They drag up this guy, the ambassador to France, as if his opinion matters about anything? Let's go back to the president for something slightly more important than Stéphane Dion. Straws.
So going back to plastic straws, these things don't work. I've had them many times, and on occasion, they break, they explode. If something's hot, they don't last very long, like a matter of minutes, sometimes a matter of seconds. It's a ridiculous situation.
What's ridiculous is the response of many in the media who've latched onto the exploding straws comment to make fun at the president, because it's easy to do. I would argue he said that phrase off the cuff, more likely, but off the cuff comments are what get him his best press, and they buy it every single time. Every time he says something that is quote-unquote stupid, they give him wall-to-wall coverage. Canadian media is outraged because this is just another environmental travesty that he's unleashing. No one ever tells you that the paper straws are full of carcinogens. No one ever talks about the absolute poor, hideous quality of a paper straw. You know, one of the things I loved about Saskatchewan, you know, one of the things I love about the West, the land of Riel, is the rebellious spirit. There were plastic straws everywhere when I moved here. There were very few paper straws, only at the big fast food chains. But you go to an actual locally owned restaurant, you were getting plastic. And unfortunately, here we are at the half hour mark. If you like the work, please consider supporting it via the website, and I'll see you in the next one. Did you know that I have a website? FrankVaughn.ca, the ultimate repository for all of my work, and a backup location just in case the censors come for me again. And if you like the content, please consider using the donate link in one of the options available. There are no paywalls, there is no advertising, and there is no Patreon, and I intend to keep it that way. Thank you for your time and your consideration.